The committee will have, going to continue with the informational meetings this morning, and the first people up will be the Office Regulatory Streaming, and I'd have Patrick Allen and Tom Gallagher come, please.
Thanks, Chair Brown, members of the committee. My name is Patrick Allen. I manage the Office of Regulatory Streamlining, which is at the Department of Consumer and Business Services. The office was created in February 2003 by the Governor's Executive Order on Regulatory Streamlining. In that order, he directed all state agencies to review their business regulations and find ways to make them simpler, faster, cheaper, easier to comply with while maintaining protections Oregonians expect for consumers, workers, public safety, health, the environment. He also directed agencies to look at customer service in permitting and regulation and find ways to improve that. The office was established within the department to facilitate state government's efforts to simplify business regulations. Corey Streisinger, the Director of Consumer and Business Services, is overall responsible for the initiative. In the office, we provide ongoing research to help agencies identify opportunities for streamlining. We serve as a clearinghouse for streamlining efforts. We help spotlight successes, share best practices, broker resources to agencies that are working on projects, and in general coordinate the efforts statewide. What I'd like to do today is to provide you a general summary of what state government's been doing over the past 2 years to streamline business regulations, to share some of the guidance that we've been providing agencies that are considering new or expanded regulations, and to get some idea of what we're encouraging them to think about, in the hopes that it might be useful to you as well. We'll also be providing an overview of the 34-bill regulatory streamlining legislative package that collectively state agencies have proposed and have before various committees, including this one. Additionally, the 2003 session of the legislature created a number of interim committees to look at various aspects of regulations in the state and streamlining efforts and make recommendations for further improvements. The one that was most tightly related to the office was created by House Bill 3120 in the last session, which created the advisory committee on agency rule streamlining. Tom Gallagher, who was here with me and presumably will be again, is the vice chair of that advisory committee, and he'll provide a brief overview of that committee's findings and recommendations. So let me, if I could, begin then by providing you an overview of the past 2 years' worth of work. You should have in front of you a copy of the report to the governor that we issued in 2004. I know many of you have received that report previously. Some haven't. This gives a good summary of about the first 12 to 18 months worth of work on the initiative. State agencies have completed or are working on or considering over 250 projects of one sort or another that streamline business regulations or regulatory processes in one fashion or another. And an additional document that you have looks like this, and it's a complete index of all 250 of those projects. And you'll find that they range from things that are really quite small to large, all-encompassing efforts. One of the challenges we've faced in the initiative is dealing with the fact that really there are relatively few big blockbuster headline kinds of projects, but lots of small incremental improvements that can be made. And we're finding that it's really the sum total of lots of small improvements that are really helping drive changes in our regulatory system. Some highlights. There are some highlights that you'll find in the gray bars in the margins of the reports, examples of projects that are completed and projects that are underway. Some of those that are listed, online address changes at the construction contractors board, so that you don't have to go in, find a form, fill it out, show up in person to do something simple like changing an address. Elimination of securities examinations at branch locations by the Division of Finance and Corporate Securities at the Department of Consumer and Business Services, so that if all the records and information that are necessary to do a good examination are at a head office, we do that and don't do the additional step of branch audit. Self-certification of continuing education by chiropractors, allowing them to look at the requirements for continuing education, take that continuing education, maintain the documentation themselves, and then the Board of Chiropractic Examiners does a percentage spot check so that there is an audit function, so that there's a whole set of paperwork and approval that just doesn't have to be done any longer. You'll also find in the report an outline of statewide business climate survey. During the past 2 years, we've completed two rounds of a business climate survey designed to assess satisfaction with government regulatory systems. First round was a statistically valid random sample of Oregon employers. The second round was more of a push survey that was put out through chambers of commerce and other business organizations to try to get a wide range of suggestions and input and those kinds of things. If you'd like, I'd be happy to go into detail on that report. All I really wanted to hit today is that one of the major outcomes of that survey was to get a quantifiable, measurable number that was basically a composite score for satisfaction with the state's business climate, the regulatory climate. We planned during the 05-07 biennium to repeat that survey. So we'll have a before and an after, or before and during kind of a measure to give ourselves some kind of a progress measure on are there changes in the way businesses perceive the regulatory climate. The last thing I'd like to highlight from the report is our online license directory. For over a year now, we've had up and running a comprehensive directory of all state business licenses, permits, certifications, anything where you got to basically have some kind of government permission or authorization. It's got about 1,100 entries, and each of those entries is a comprehensive listing of what are the statutes and rules related, what are the requirements to get a license, what are the fees, continuing education, upfront testing, those kinds of things. There are direct links to agency websites, downloadable application forms, and we've even now managed to link in where they exist in many cases, direct links to databases of licensees, so that if what you really want isn't how do I get a hairdresser's license, but how do I find out if someone is licensed to be a hairdresser, you can do that. We think that combination of all those pieces of information accessible in one source make it the most comprehensive tool of its kind in the country. Through all the work that we've been doing in the past 2 years, we've learned, I think, some useful lessons. One of the initial surprises that we ran into was really how difficult it turned out to really be able to get from businesses really specific actionable suggestions of what kinds of things to work on, what sorts of systems to improve, how to get past kind of the notion of regulations are really a problem, to kind of drilling down to what regulations and what areas. I think it could be tempting maybe to see that result and assume that maybe streamlining isn't as important as we had first thought. But clearly, I think that would not be the right interpretation. Instead, I think it helps illustrate that a fundamental problem could be characterized as one of cumulative impacts of regulation rather than individual problems. I can illustrate that by relating the situation for small retailers, an area that convenience stores, something that I think I've begun to conclude is one of the most regulated, if not the most regulated business in Oregon. If you run a convenience store and have the typical range of products, you sell gas out front, you got beer and wine, cigarettes, lottery tickets, those kinds of things, you have 12 different state agencies that license, permit, audit, inspect, or in some way interact with the business. Each one of those is, you know, perfectly logical. Department of Agriculture is worried about food safety in the deli case, and that's perfectly legitimate. DEQ has a permitting process for the underground storage tanks to make sure that we don't have the same problem down the road that we had a few years ago. And so it goes through the different kinds of licenses. But when you add it all up, one on top of the other on top of the other, it becomes a pretty significant burden for the retailer. Now, in that particular area, we've pulled together a number of those agencies that actually provide some kind of an annual license or certification, and we're working on a pilot project to see if we can't combine them into a single license. Right now, that involves DEQ, OLCC, and agriculture, so that instead of dealing with three agencies once a year, filling out a form, renewing information, a lot of it the same, you deal with one transaction, and then we worry about how to split the information and the funds and those kinds of things up. The legislature will actually likely see a bill shortly. We'll need some legislation to authorize that pilot because we need to do some things like one agency, the fee is late after 20 days and another agency is late after 30 days, and we'll need some broad authority to fix that stuff, but also some ability to incorporate other agencies beyond those first three if we're able to expand this pilot. Second area I'd like to touch on is legislative concepts, the guidance we provided to agencies. You should have in front of you a document that looks like this, called Factors Agencies Should Weigh When Evaluating the Need for New or Expanded Regulations. We went into the legislative concept drafting process really wanting to make sure that agencies' work in this area reflected the governor's intent in terms of trying to make sure that regulations were as streamlined as possible and could draw a good link to public protection. I would summarize that, oh, this is about a three-page document, I would summarize it with maybe sort of five overarching questions. These are questions that we basically asked agencies, and they needed to provide some kind of answer to be able to get concepts forward. They may well be good questions for you to ask as you see proposals that will undoubtedly come before you for new or expanded regulation, often completely supported by the industry that's being regulated. Even in those cases, it may be useful to ask things like, exactly who or what are we protecting and how? Is the problem real and current, or is it something we're worried may happen if we don't regulate? Is regulation the only effective means of dealing with that problem? Is the regulation that's being proposed designed in a way that minimizes economic impact while maximizing the public protection that's been identified? Is there a way to assess the effectiveness of the regulation and make changes or abandon it if it doesn't work? Some basic overarching questions, and the rest of this document really is sort of detail on those themes. What I'd like to do before turning it over to Tom then is talk about the regulatory streamlining legislative package. You should have a document that says regulatory streamlining legislative agenda that looks like this, minus all the pen and ink marks. It's 34 bills that make up, submitted by about a dozen agencies that make up our streamlining package. Like the regulatory streamlining projects we discussed earlier, these bills range from significant regulatory changes to small individual improvements that, taken collectively, can make a meaningful difference in the state's regulatory climate. Let me give you a couple of examples. I talked about the license directory earlier, and in looking at the licenses in that directory, we identified a whole cluster of them that are one-year licenses. And we asked the question, well, why are they one-year licenses? Some of them, take for example amusement park rides, thank heavens it's a one-year license and somebody actually comes out and looks at the ride to make sure it's still safe and those kinds of things. Others of them, for example, electrical contracting business is a one-year license. And you ask the question, could that be a two-year license or a three-year license without damaging public safety or protection or those kinds of things? And from a policy standpoint, probably the answer is yeah, that may well be the case. The issue is statutorily it's identified as a one-year license. From a practical standpoint, agencies are kind of loath to want to do a bill to say, let's take this from a one-year license to a two-year license. So you'll have in front of the legislature this session, House Bill 2094, which attempts to deal with that across state government, and it provides broad authority for regulatory agencies if doing so is consistent with the public protection they're trying to provide, to offer extended license terms. Second example, it has to do with sworn statements. A number of licenses require that that the application or other reporting requirements for certain kinds of regulation be done by sworn statement. In Oregon, that means you have to show up in front of a notary and the document has to be notarized. The downside of that is whether it's a periodic report that has to be notarized or an application, it means that there's absolutely no way to do that electronically because there's no effective means of electronic notarization. You kind of dig down and ask, why are they required to be notarized? And really, it appears to be a tool that gets more than we really need. If the document weren't notarized, an agency would still be perfectly free to provide in its rules that if you submitted false information, you lose your license. You'd still be able to charge someone with unsworn falsification. The only thing you lose is the ability to go and have a DA charge them with the felony of perjury. And you ask, well, do we actually do that? And the answer generally is no, we don't do that. So we have a bill, you'll have a bill this session that will... again, propose for a list of about eight agencies to remove that sworn statement requirement. Final comment in wrapping up. I mentioned at the outset that the Office of Regulatory Streamlining is part of the Department of Consumer and Business Services. I think I really need to mention that not only has the department itself, the state's largest business regulatory agency, done a lot of work in terms of generating projects and identifying best practices and those kinds of things, but they've provided a huge amount of direct support to the initiative overall. The license directory is a product of the Information Management Department there. So whether it's information management, marketing, or those kinds of things, the department has been hugely helpful statewide on this initiative. What I'd like to do now is turn over to Tom Gallagher to talk about one of the advisory committee efforts that occurred over the session created by House Bill 3120 to give you some information about their findings and recommendations. Tom?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Tom Gallagher from Legislative Advocates. I have been working with Pat on these issues for the last 2 years at about 10 hours a week. And he just ran through this and made it sound like somebody cleaning their garage. He wanted to get it all in. This has been, in the 30 years I've been doing this, probably the best, most practical amount of time I've spent on government regulation. Working with Pat and Corey Streisinger and Stephanie Halleck and others on this committee, we really began for the first time, I think, to get into what we should be doing with state agencies in the 21st century. These were all built in the 1920s to the 1970s, and the world, information technology, purposes of the agencies and so forth has changed drastically, and yet we really don't ever get a chance to take a very deep look at it. I think that this committee needs to spend an important amount of time thinking about the philosophy of business regulation. Not one thing that we approached during this interim was to change one jot or iota of policy outcomes. It was not an attempt to find a way to skirt a regulation, not an attempt to remove a burden that would produce a good public policy outcome, but was a burden for business. I think the philosophy of streamlining rules and regulations, making it work in the 21st century, has two very important and very practical pieces for this committee. Number one, I think there is a way to reduce government costs for government, for your budget. Sometimes it's not general funds, sometimes it's only fees and other applications. But I think there are cost efficiencies in the sort of things that Pat talked about with convenience stores and all the time and effort agencies put into going out and duplicating the inspections of the stores and so forth. Those fees, those dollars can be spent better on delivering service to the public. So I think you can get a double bang for your buck if you spend the time thinking about this. Secondly, the regulated community pays a very high price, and it's oftentimes not in the cost of the fee. It's in the cost of the preparation. It's the hiring of the architect for your building plans. It's the getting the architect to change the plans after you've gone through the building codes. For large permittees, it can result in $1 million worth of consulting costs. And the consultant having to go around and track down and find the right body and the right agency to coordinate and communicate to make everything line up for the permittee as they work their way through the process. So I think there are huge cost savings both inside and outside of the process without changing one jot, title, or iota of public policy outcome. Over the course of the interim, what John Chandler and I tried to do last time was to pass two pieces of legislation. One is 3120, which was rules streamlining. The other, 2011, which set up a series of interim committees to look at permit streamlining. Both of those reports, I hope that you will sit down and spend some time reading. You will find, I think, the 3120 committee report the clearest and most effective. In my judgment, others disagree with me, but in my judgment, the benefit of the 2011 committee report are in the appendices, where the raw committees went out and the working committees went out and looked at the raw data, and it got rolled up into the 2011. 3120, do you have this report, the 3120 report? If you turn to page 4, I'm just going to talk for a second about some of the principles, the philosophy on page 4 of that report that the committee concluded. And before I do that, I'll talk about when John Chandler and I originally wrote 3120, we went in to meet with Dave Hendricks with a whole bunch of ideas how to improve agency efficiency. Yeah, that's good. Yes. It's called the Report of Agency Advisory Committee on Agency Rule Streamlining. We went in and sat down with Dave Hendricks with a whole bunch of ideas. And Dave looked at us, he's legislative counsel. He said, That's in there. It's already in there. That's already in there. And every idea we had was already in Section 183. You're going to have a bill in front of you, a House Bill 2188, which is one of the results of this committee, which is fixing some of the stupid things we lobbyists did in Section 183, which is the administrative rules process, trying to get our hands and fingers around the throats of some agency that was annoying the hell out of us. And we put a lot of that stuff in there, and we didn't achieve the outcome that we wanted. And I'm going to talk in this on page 4 about some of the reasons why we didn't achieve those outcomes. The first one is an amazing admission for most of us in this building. There is no substitute for good agency management. And it's not something the legislature can do anything about, really. I mean, you approve boards and commissions, and sometimes you approve people who are going to run agencies. But by and large, that's done by the executive branch. Your advice here, philosophically and guidance-wise, occurs down in Ways and Means, where bad agency managers get the stuffings thrashed out of them over a series of sessions. And you know the kinds of bills that budgets that I'm talking about, and you know some of the changes that have taken place over time. So the legislature does get into that process, but at the end, and probably in the most brutal way. But philosophically, as people come before you with bills to change business regulations and add different layers in business regulations, and if you go back and look at Pat's statement on regulatory, where is it, Pat, the one you gave him? This is actually has been put into the AG's manual on rule writing. This is Corey Streisinger's and Stephanie Halleck's lecture to agency managers. Now, how you get people to do things the right way, the most efficient way, the most profitable way, does depend on management, and not much we can do about it here. The second one is there's no silver bullet for rulemaking that will magically make every government regulation acceptable to all parties. Some people don't want to be regulated. Some people don't like to turn in the information. Some people want more regulation. Whatever you do, you are never going to get rid of this debate between the regulated community and the public sector side, or public, the consumer side. So there's no cork in the bottle you can pull out. What there is making the process itself more efficient. And that's the most difficult thing to do because it normally involves interagency cooperation, communication, and coordination. And quite frankly, it starts with the statute. When you stick a statute in for one agency, that agency can't avoid it. They can't delegate that duty to another agency. You've got a statute on water in 8 different agencies. So 8 different agencies have to get involved in some way in that water permit. Now, how in the world can that be an efficient process unless those agencies are so staffed to the gills with people that do nothing but wander around and follow your project around in each application that comes in? And since we don't have any general fund left in those agencies, that all gets paid for, or a large part of it, gets paid for by the regulated community. So there's no cork in the bottle. Now, how do you guys get involved in process? Well, I don't know how you're going to do that yet. And I'm going to end this, my little piece of this, with a big complaint about whose responsibility, who can do that, how can we do it. Number 3 is the idea of reducing government regulation is a bumper sticker and nothing more. 90% of regulations are supported by the regulated community and the consumer protection and the general public that is involved in that regulation. What you hear about are the rocks in the shoe. You hear about the sore thumbs that got hit with a hammer. You hear about the outstanding problems. And if you could, as they come in front of this committee, if you could make them focus on what's gone wrong in that agency or that process, you might be able to send that lobby and that agency back out to solve the problem in a different way than sticking another statute in. Pat says I need to wrap it up.
Subtly.
The third one is a need to review arcane and ineffective regulations. And most of those are driven by statutes. And the agencies don't have the money to do this. And I'll be darned, there's an interest group that will pop up and come up here in front of you and slit their wrists to protect that regulation. Why? I don't know. Hopefully none of them are my clients. But the economic of individual regulations affect small business. And if you do nothing, it's not going to get you headlines in the paper. It's what Pat talked about in this convenience store stuff. It's It's trying to take some of the just accounting and reporting and duplication and over involvement off of small business. Let me end with saying that lobbyists can't solve this problem. Lobbyists aren't going to bring you forward bills that are going to solve this problem. The general public is going to come in and complain, and they're going to point you in a direction, and that's valuable, and you can listen to that. But how you solve that problem is a bit more difficult. My complaint is, by and large, agencies aren't going to help you solve this problem. And the reason agencies aren't is not because they're bad people, because they're inefficient people, or any of that. You are one of the externalities that affects the way they do business. Just like any of you who are in private business have, your business is impacted all the time by events that happen in your line of work. And you have to adjust to it because you're not big enough, strong enough, tough enough, rich enough to overcome those externalities. There are very few externalities for state agencies. You are probably the only one. And if you don't have a plan or a direction or a way to say to state agencies, think about it again. I think you can do that more efficiently. I think you could do that more effectively. This office, the Office of Regulatory Streamlining, is, again, like the Community Solutions team or the ERT team, layers that we put on from the top down to go back and try to get folks to do this. Your responsibility is they have statutory requirements that make them write those regulations and make them be active in that area and limit the way that they can delegate, interrelate, do business, etc. I don't know how in the world you would pull out every statute and fix that. I think we're going to have to devise some process. Now, I'll stop and say is that I've spent a lot of time, none of it client-related, on this stuff, and I'm willing to spend a lot more time. But we've done just about as much as we can from the outside without having some legislators grab this by the throat and start ordering us to shake up this system. Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, happy to answer any questions you have.
Committee, do you feel like you just tried to take a drink out of the fire hose? Patrick, you were talking about the convenience store, and you talked about the 12 state agencies. How many local government agencies are also in there regulating them, cities and counties and special districts?
Well, Chair Brown, that's a great question, and it kind of raises a whole larger set of issues. In that particular area, if we're not talking about something where the operator is trying to expand or build, there's actually reasonably little local regulation. Local regulation, though, it becomes a huge issue. If you look at that survey I talked about earlier, and you kind of scratch down into the information that's there, if you really press a business on its concerns about regulations, frequently you find a local government that's somewhere involved in that, whether it's implementing state law or a state process, or federal or doing its own thing. There is a piece of that that's certainly local government. We're beginning right now to work with the Association of Counties and League of Cities on identifying some pilot projects around the state involving local governments where state and local governments work together and identify some of these regulatory processes and figure out ways that we can work to improve them and then develop tools or best practices that we can share more broadly with local government.
Mr. Chair, if I might add something there that local governments, by and large, are responsive to the members of their community, and I say by and large meaning almost completely. And some communities vary in the way that the types of pressures they put on government to get involved in business regulation. We generally stop dead short of trying to do any state and local coordination because you get into the philosophical problem of local preemption. Now, if you want to take on a subject like that, I advise you not to. But fixing the state pieces would set an example, would be a tremendous help, would give everybody a direction for how to do this. The city of Portland, if you go on their website, has had just a huge amount of information on how they do permit streamlining. And I assume that they have done a great deal of permit streamlining. None of my Portland business clients want to bring that down here as a model, but I think they're working at it.
Mr. Chair, to respond to your question, if you have a street tree or if you have a sign, local government is really involved. Just wanted to comment on the two subjects of regulation.
Thank you. Any other questions? I think those bills that were mentioned there, we have five of them now, as Janet referred to our committee so far.
That's right.
Thank you very much, Patrick.
Thank you.
It's intimidating and overwhelming.
Mr. Chair, I'm going to leave with you a couple of documents. One is a list of all of the different documents that I have been using and looking at that deals with this problem. And the second is a summary of all the committees and subcommittees that have been meeting on this. And I think you will see that there's a tremendous amount of effort, not just on 3120, but on the full look. And that includes land use.
Thank you, Tom. Today we're going to be looking at some bills that deal with the insurance pool governing. And so we invited Rocky King to come and talk to us about it.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Rocky King. I'm the administrator for the Insurance Pool Governing Board and also the Oregon Medical Insurance Pool. And I believe, Mr. Chair, that we were going to do about a 10 or 15-minute overview of the agencies, because not only will you have these three bills, but we have approximately five bills that are starting on the Senate side that, based on where the assignments are going, that you're going to end up getting. I want to start off by saying I'm glad that this doesn't mimic the confirmation hearings of Condoleezza Rice, because I don't know if I could take that at this hour in the morning. Let me first say that this is the first time really any of our bills or our agency has been before this committee in the 15 years that I've been here. That's good news and it's bad news. The bad news is that you don't have really a background of the agencies and what they've done and what their missions are and their accomplishments. The good news is we do get an opportunity to do that, and hopefully we'll come away with seven or eight legislators that have a better understanding of the Insurance Pool Governing Board and what we intend to do, what we've done, as well as the Oregon Medical Insurance Pool. And I want to start off by I'm going to give you an overview of the Oregon Medical Insurance Pool and the Insurance Pool Governing Board, but first to really look at the Oregon Health Plan as a concept. You know, when you read in the papers and as the budget people in Ways and Means, they deal with the Oregon Health Plan as a part of Medicaid. And they look at it from a financial standpoint to a large degree as a public program. But the Oregon Health Plan, as it was envisioned in the early 1990s, was more than just Medicaid. It was a significant number of insurance market reforms that took place from 1987 all the way through 1995. It was also the Insurance Pool Governing Board, which we'll talk about, where we worked in the private sector to assist small businesses to purchase health insurance. It was the employer mandate. I don't know if you're aware of this, but in 1989, the legislature passed an employer mandate that was going to require all employers in the state of Oregon to provide health insurance to their employees. That was later phased out in 1995 when no ERISA exemption could be obtained for that. We also have OMIP, the high-risk pool for Oregonians, again on the private sector side. So the Oregon Health Plan was really a concept that was bigger than just the Medicaid program. It covered both the public and private sector. And it did this because if you go back, and we've handed out some statistics to you, I believe they're in your form or in the blue folder. If you go back to 1990 and 1992, we had about 18% of all Oregonians uninsured. We had an uninsurance rate for children in 1990 that was almost 20%. And the legislature and then Governor Goldschmidt, and later Governor Roberts and Governor Kitzhaber, and really looked at addressing this uninsurance problem, not just from the public side, but also from the private sector side. The uninsurance rates, again, for all Oregonians, about 18% in 1992, and for children, very significant, about 18.5%. The success that we saw between 1990, 1992, and if you look at your forms, 1996, where we saw the rate for children drop to under 8% and the rate for all Oregonians under 11%, really was based on a number of factors. First of all, there was the expansion of Medicaid. We added about 100,000 people to the insured rolls just through the expansion of the public programs. But it was more importantly, it was the economy. If you go back to the mid-1990s, it was the economy that was driving jobs, business profits where they could afford health insurance. Health insurance premium trends were very stable, if not low. We had universal access, almost guaranteed issue in all of our products. And the population during that time grew between 90, 92, and the end of maybe 98 by about 400,000 to 500,000 people. Yet the number of people uninsured dropped from about 450,000 down to about 380. So you had about 500,000 people who got insurance in this state during that 6 or 7 year period of time. Only 100,000 of those received that through Medicaid. The other was all private sector. Employer-based coverage was really working at that point. Well, then things, as we all know, turned upside down, and things have changed since then. The loss of managed care, the health care trends are going higher, the economy is in the tubes. For the late 90s, early 2000 period of time, you saw the Medicaid, because of the state budget crisis, start to pull back. So if you look at those sheets, you'll see that just announced this week was an uninsurance rate that's climbed all the way back up to 17%. And for children, a little bit better than where we were early in the 90s, but it is still at about 12.3%. 609,000 Oregonians currently are uninsured. That's one in every six Oregonians. So we have a significant number of people that are both from a public as well as a private sector perspective are lacking the ability to access health care. So that kind of gives you kind of an overview quickly that we're kind of in some tough times right now, not just from a public sector, but from the private sector. Give you an idea, in the early 90s or the mid-90s, 49% of families offered coverage for family coverage through employers were taking that coverage. That is dropped to 29% of family coverage, not employee, family coverage, with latest figures that have come out in the last year. Significant number of dependents no longer get their coverage through their employer. So that the programs I'm going to talk about today really are kind of designed to support the private sector piece of the equation as opposed to the public. Let me talk about Medicaid for, or excuse me, OMIP first, the high risk pool. In 1990, if you worked for a small employer who did not provide health insurance and you had diabetes, hypertension, cancer, any significant health care condition, you couldn't get it through your employer. They didn't offer it, so you'd go out to the individual market and you'd get turned down because of those health reasons. There was no option for you. You either got insurance in the private sector individual market or you had no insurance whatsoever. So the legislature in 1989 really established the Oregon Medical Insurance Pool as a high-risk health insurance pool, basically saying anybody turned down for individual health insurance coverage for medical reasons could come to OMIP and we would cover them on a guaranteed issue basis, provide them with the health care benefits to meet some of the significant chronic health care conditions that they have. It's a state agency. It offers four benefit plans, and there's some information in the brochure, or in the blue brochure, that gives you what those benefit plans and rates are. It's provided statewide, and it's funded basically using two sources, premiums and assessments. Those people who enroll in OMIP pay basically about 120% of the average premium charged in the regular market. So there is a small surcharge. The board can go up to 125%, but it's a little bit lower than that right now. So if somebody's charged $100 in the regular market for a particular coverage, they will pay $120 for their OMIP coverage. But the problem is, for every dollar in premium we collect, we expend about $1.60 in claims. When you concentrate this number of people with high risk conditions and the chronic health conditions they have, your losses are going to be far higher than what your premiums are. Of course, that's the reason why they're rejected in the regular market. So we have the ability under OMIP statutes to assess health insurers based on their share of their market share throughout the state to cover any losses that the pool incurs on a year-by-year basis. And an example of that is that we just recently assessed for about $15 million to cover our losses for a six-month period of all Oregon health insurers. If you have health insurance, about $1.50 of your premium every month per member goes to help support the 10,400 people that are enrolled in the high-risk pool. In 1996, in addition to medically eligible individuals coming into the pool, the Oregon legislature passed a law allowing those people who left group coverage and didn't have a portability option available to them the ability to come to the pool with no surcharge, basically to pay the same rate they would pay in the private sector market. Of the 10,500 people we currently have in the pool, about 2,000 of those are what we call portability eligible. Let me give you an example. You work for a large firm like Tektronix, who may be self-insured. You leave that company for whatever reason, wherever you go. You exhaust your 18 months of COBRA. You have chronic health conditions. Where can you go? Well, there is no carrier that's probably going to accept you, so not just on a health basis, but the fact that you are porting coverage from your employer. You're leaving your employer. You can come to the pool and get coverage. You work for a small company in Portland, and you have Kaiser, and you leave that company and go to work for a company down in Medford where there is no Kaiser. You can basically take that and move from Kaiser plan to the portability plans offered by OMIP. Who are the people that enroll in this? 60% female, average age is 50 years old. You are generally talking about an older population, primarily a female population, and 62% earn under $35,000 a year. So it's not a group of very wealthy folks, just a lot of people that are scrambling to get coverage and very often lower income. So OMIP's been around now for about 14 years, and again, we've served over 35,000 individuals during that time and currently have about 10,400 people enrolled. Now let me talk to you a little bit about the Insurance Pool Governing Board. And if you turn on, there's an agency overview, and on page, I believe it's 8, some people get confused because I talk about OMIP and I talk about IPGB. So they're kind of two different agencies, and let me speak to that a little bit. In 1993, OMIP was its own separate state agency, along with the Insurance Pool Governing Board was also a separate state agency. But since 1990, they had a common administrator and common administrative staff. That was a decision made very early to share administrative staff, even though they were separate state agencies. In 1993, OMIP, under some of the consolidation of small agencies that took place during the Roberts administration, became a part of the Department of Consumer and Business Services. It has a board that's made up of carrier and advocate and provider representatives that make all the decisions from a policy standpoint, what the rates are, what the benefits are going to be, how much to assess. But administratively, OMIP is under DCBS, and so half of me reports to the director, Corey Streisinger, of DCBS. Actually, the whole thing report my whole body to her, I guess, but we kind of split that administrative responsibility between DCBS, OMIP, and the Insurance Pool Governing Board. The Insurance Pool Governing Board was established as a separate state agency and has remained that since its inception in 1987. But again, through the administrative agreement, we administer both programs and share administrative staff. If you look at the functions on page 9, we have OMIP, customer service, marketing, and outreach. Basically, I'll give you an example of that. We received last week our five customer service staff, over 2,500 calls from individuals looking for assistance in one of our programs or one of the state's programs or just trying to find out information about health insurance. These are uninsured folks. These are small employers, health insurance agents who just need to plug in to some resource that hopefully we can connect them with. We run the Family Health Insurance Assistance Program, which I'll talk about in a little bit more detail later. We're involved in training and outreach, whether it be DHS offices on the private market options that some of their clients may want to look at. We train agents. We run an agent referral system. We have a list of agents, so when somebody calls us and says, I need help finding health insurance, we can plug them, whether it's in Burns or whether it's in Portland, whether it's in Woodburn, whether it's if they need a Russian speaking or Spanish speaking agent, we can plug them into an agent in their local community that can help them really navigate the very difficult process of obtaining health insurance. We'll do the certified plans, which we'll talk about in a few minutes, for to assist small businesses that are uninsured get insurance by providing them with some different options not available to them in the market. So when I talk about OMIP and I talk about IPGB and FEOP, they really all come together, and they're all private sector components of the Oregon Health Plan as opposed to the public sector. Let's talk about the IPGB. Established 1987, first offered certified plans to small businesses, and what that means is basically low cost, more catastrophic oriented, although not at that time high deductibles, but low cost plans. We came out in 1989 with a plan that was $53.33 per month per employee. You can't drive your car past a hospital for that price anymore, but they were very inexpensive. We had about six carriers, the major carriers in the state that offered these plans. And initially, not very many businesses enrolled, even though there was a tax credit associated with those plans and that their share of the premium was only required to be $40 per month per employee. But in 1993, with the expansion of the Medicaid, Greg Walden, when he was sitting where you guys are sitting now, put together a marketing package and gave us funds to finally go out and begin marketing that program. And where we only had maybe 3,000 or 4,000 employees and dependents enrolled in 1993, by 1996 we had over 36,000 employees and dependents enrolled in the certified plans. But business was good. We had a lot of people that were there. We had all the market reforms that took place in the 90s, managed care. We had what we call the Hillary effect, that is, prices were being kept pretty low because there was concern about a national health care system. And so the board in 1998 said, you know, everything's working. People are starting to get coverage in the regular market. We have guaranteed issue. We have the high-risk pool expansion of Medicaid. There's really no reason for the certified plans. And we worked with the carriers on this. And a decision was made to recommend to the 1990 legislature to phase out the IPGB certified plans. By then, our population had dropped down to about 17,000. And the primary reason is people were exiting our market and going to the regular market. Trends were low, premiums were pretty good, stable. A lot of carriers were offering a lot of different plans. So in 1999, the legislature decided and agreed with the board and the governor to phase out the plans, and we basically stopped offering them in the year 2000. Well, then medical inflation turned up. economy went upside down, managed care went away, employers started reducing benefits and raising cost sharing for their employees, started reducing the contribution levels that they were putting towards employee coverage. Many employers were dropping dependent coverage altogether, and this, quite frankly, was in reaction to the economy. The economy in the late 90s, starting the year 2000, was turning upside down. In the year 2001, Representative Mary Nolan and Representative Krummel said, you know, maybe we shouldn't have closed this. We see the trends going the other way. Uninsurance going higher, businesses dropping coverage. Let's get back in the business of offering certified plans. And they passed a bill that had some flaws to it because it was done late in the session that kept us from implementing that. And we worked with Representative Nolan to try to fix that into the 2003 session. And there were a variety of bills introduced in 2003 that said get back into the business. And the one that finally prevailed was sponsored by Representatives Mona Sanderson, Verger, Cruz, and Gordon Anderson. Two of those are now obviously in the Senate. It was House Bill 2537. A little bit different than Mary Nolan's bill, Representative Nolan's bill, in that it said first that these plans can be purchased by employers that had been uninsured as of July 2003 or were a new business that came into existence after that date. So we're not talking about focusing on businesses that already have insurance, but we're talking about the new certified plans focusing only on those businesses that are currently uninsured. Secondly, the plans were not going to be subject to the mandates. The only way to get the price down is to increase cost sharing or reduce some of the benefits. So the board went to work. We didn't receive any staff or resources to do this because, again, the state budget was very tight at that point. The board went to work after the session looking at different options of what it could do and couldn't do. And I want to spend a couple of minutes talking about what it is that they have proposed and will be implemented March 1 of this year. We targeted, first of all, an employer plan that was 30% less expensive than the normal plans purchased by small businesses. And the only way to achieve that was to really provide some significant cost sharing, some limits on some of the benefits, and some exclusion of benefits. For example, the alternative plan does not include mental health benefits. In your packet, you'll see this right here. Called Small Employer Health Plan, and on the almost the last page, the first one is the Children's Health Plan, and I'll talk about that in a minute, you'll see where it says Alternative Group Plan. Usually a small business plan will have $1 to $3 million lifetime max. We reduce premium savings primarily by reducing the lifetime maximum to $500,000. We have an annual benefit maximum for the first 2 years of only $50,000. What we basically are trying to do, very frankly, is bring in the lower wage, younger, healthy workers, because those are the folks who've said, I don't need to pay the kind of money to purchase health insurance and have exited the market. We need to bring some of those folks back in by providing some basic initial coverage that can be considered somewhat catastrophic if they stay with it for a couple years, but at least just cover some of the basic benefits, hospital and doctor and pharmaceutical costs when they initially purchase it. Has an annual deductible of about $1,000. And an RX benefit that does provide some incentives to purchase generics. And again, if you get into some of the name brand drugs that we see on television advertised, the amount of copayments increases substantially, or in some cases are not covered unless someone's life is at risk. So we have actually some non-preferred name drugs that we will not cover unless it is a life-saving drug. And there are some cases, for example, with transplants, where it may not be a preferred drug, but they need it in order to survive, and so we will pay for those. But we've limited a number of services, do not provide for dental, immunizations, vision, well baby or well child care, and mental health chemical dependency, both inpatient and outpatient. Again, our target was 30% reduction in premiums. Now, while that might be fine for an adult, the board felt very strongly that was not a good approach to take with children. So they developed an alternative to the alternative plan, which is called the Children's Group Plan, which is on the inside cover. Basically, it is a very good product with a lower deductible of $500 versus $1,000. There are no initial limitations. It provides a full range of well baby care, hospital doctor, a little bit better drug benefit, especially the generics, where all generic drugs are only $5. This copay, this benefit package is a very good benefit package and probably is somewhat better than most benefit packages that children are enrolled in the small group market today. So the board took...
Representative Schaffler. Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. These drug benefits, are they only for drugs that have to do with life-threatening or... For example, would they cover women's contraceptives or Viagra?
Mr. Chair, Representative Schaffler, I'm going to ask him. I believe they would.
I'm not sure. I know that the former standard
yes.
They will cover contraceptives.
Not Viagra.
They don't believe it will cover Viagra.
Thank you.
That wasn't on the record.
Yeah, the answer wasn't on the record, so could we get repeated? And then
Mr. Chair, drugs, and I believe it is standard, do cover women's contraceptives. They do not cover Viagra. They cover more than life-saving drugs in the generics and preferred name. We use the formularies offered by the two carriers. But for the non-preferred, we basically, except for the children, say we won't cover them unless they're life-threatening. Now, the cost of the children's plan will be basically the same cost you'll see in the group market. It's not cheaper. But we can go to an employer now and say, look, we have a benefit package, the alternative group plan, for your employees or your employees' spouses. For your children, we have the children's plan, and you have a lot of options in terms of how you configure that. If you don't want to cover your employees and their spouses, you can cover just their children. And that's one of the selling points that some of the agents said that they want to use with some of those businesses. The employer can't provide and can't afford coverage for the employees, but maybe we can have them step up or her step up and say, but I am going to make some contribution so at least we can get the kids covered. Or they can say we're only going to cover the employee and the employee's spouse or just the employee. So we've given them really configuration of three or four options they can look at, starting from the employee down to the down to the children. Going to a children's group plan is turning the market upside down. When you talk to health insurance agents and carriers, they call small employers and say, we want you to buy a product for your employees. The small employer says, I can't afford it. Now we can go to them and say, great, that's a decision you have to make, but how about at least looking at the children of that employee? We're pretty excited that to try this and see if it works. We have no idea. Our focus groups with small employers and health insurance agents has been positive, but we'll see what happens when we come out March 1st with that particular program.
Excuse me just a minute, Rocky. Representative Kitts.
I'm looking at the RX benefit here, and I had a question. Can you explain to me what the difference between can you explain what a non-preferred name drug would be? An example of? I mean, it's not covered, but I just don't know when that applies.
Mr. Chair, Representative Kitts, I don't take a lot of drugs, so I'm not going to be able to give you the exact names of some of these drugs.
I hope you're not lying that I do take a lot of drugs. I don't need that.
But generally, you'll have, for example, you'll have six or seven drugs that you might be able to take for high blood pressure. And there are some of those where the evidence shows that they work better than others. And insurance company will put those on a preferred list and say, if you want the drug that we've negotiated a good rate for and the evidence says works better than these other drugs, then that'll be a preferred drug and you'll have a lower copay than if you take one of the non-preferred.
Okay. Gotcha. Thanks.
Thank you.
Yep.
All right.
Two carriers, Health Net and Regents Blue Cross Blue Shield of Oregon, have stepped forward to offer these plans, and we're pretty excited. All carriers had an opportunity to participate, and they are the ones that put their boats in the on the river to go down the river with us, not knowing quite how it's going to come out. And I want to say publicly, I appreciate Regents and Health Net both stepping up to what has been the governor's concern and the legislature's concern of trying to figure out a way to encourage small businesses to enroll in health plans. We start training on, and you've probably received an invitation for this, but we start training 23 cities between January 25th and the first week of March. We're rolling this out. We'll first start with the health insurance agents and communities throughout the state, and then we hope to implement this again on March 1st of this year. So stay tuned for some of the numbers. Let me talk briefly about the Family Health Insurance Assistance Program. 1997, and there are some people behind me here who were actually a part of some of those early initiatives. The legislature recognized that there were thousands of Oregonians that made too much money to qualify for Medicaid. They were employed, and because they earned minimum wage and worked 40 hours a week and maybe had one or two people in their family, they just didn't qualify to get public assistance. Yet it was their taxes that were supporting people enrolling in Medicaid, Medicare, and to support the business deductions for health insurance. So there's this whole people basically between 100 and 200% of poverty that are out there working for small employers that generally don't provide health insurance, supporting people that earn less than them to purchase or to get public insurance, but yet they themselves couldn't afford it. So they wanted to start what's called the Family Health Insurance Assistance Program. Basically, it is a program designed to subsidize low-income Oregonians under 185% of the federal poverty to purchase private health insurance. That's private health insurance, either through their employer or their employee, through the individual market. I want to call your attention to page 10 of the agency overview, because when we first put FEOP together, we went before the legislature and said, here are the principles upon which we want to really run this program. First of all, it was one to foster independence and self-reliance. People were going to have to participate in the premiums, in the co-pays, and the deductibles. That was going to encourage comparison shopping. We were going to give people choice. For the individual market, we have six carriers and a multitude of plans that they have the option to choose from. We were going to respect confidentiality and maintain personal dignity. When somebody has a FEOP subsidy and is able to purchase health insurance, either through their employer or the individual market, they walk into the doctor's office with a Blue Cross card, with a Health Net card, rather than a state Medicaid card. So they're just, their dignity is a lot different. They have the same health care card as somebody they're working right next to or living right next to. We wanted this not to be an entitlement. One of the first decisions about FEOP is that it would be budget driven, not demand driven. So if we're given $23 million, we spend $23 and you close the program down. And in fact, when we first started, they wanted us to open up the doors with about 15,000 openings, people, and they closed the doors because of budget crisis when we had about 7,500, and we developed a waiting list that was over 10,000. So rather than going to the emergency board, getting additional funds, rather than busting the budget and coming back, we were given the ability to develop what basically our waiting or reservation list for the program. When we ran out of slots, we closed the program, and people on a first-come, first-served basis would come in. We build on the current system. We didn't want to design new plans. We wanted to use what employers were offering and what the individual market carriers were offering to their folks. And one of the more controversial parts, though, is that we wanted to cover those people that were uninsured for a period of 6 months, and that was a part of a federal waiver. That is one of the most inequitable parts about the FEOP program. The legislature knows this. We've debated it from day one. But in order to get federal dollars eventually, eventually, and I'll talk about that in a few minutes, we had to have a period of uninsurance. We don't have enough money to give everybody below 200% a subsidy. We only have, for example, there are about 400,000 or 500,000 or 600,000 people below or between 100 and 200% of poverty. About 130 to 140,000 of those are uninsured, and we've got enough slots really to only serve about 16 to 18,000 of those individuals. So it's budget-driven rather than demand-driven. FEOP started as a state-funded only program, and in 1999 and the year and 2001 legislature directed the Department of Human Services to go to the federal government to get a federal waiver that would allow us to use federal dollars, Title 19 and Title 21 dollars, to expand the number of people that we could serve. And initially, we had enough money at that point for about 7,500 folks, and we got initial authorization to expand up to about 25,000 enrolled in the program. That never happened because in the 2001 legislative session, we again had a budget crisis, and we had to pull back to about 15,000, which is what we can serve now, although we're going to try to go a little bit above that because we have some savings. So we got a federal waiver that really matches the federal dollars with the state dollars for us to expand this program considerably from what we first talked about. And an example is in the governor's 2005-07 budget. We have about an $81 million budget, of which $26 million is state funds. The remaining are federal funds. We get pretty good leverage. Some of that is about a 60-40, 60 cents federal funds for 40 cents of state funds. That's Title 19. And for Title 21, we get about 71 cents for every 29 cents of state dollars we put in. So we've been able to leverage those dollars extremely well. On page, I believe it is, 15, you can see a little bit of the eligibility requirements for FEOP. First of all, they must reside in Oregon. They must be a U.S. citizen or qualified non-citizen. Must have been without health insurance for the previous 6 months. The exception to that is people coming off of Medicaid, because part of the idea of this program was a transition. People, we didn't want them to turn down a 50 cent an hour raise because they would lose their health care benefits, that hopefully they could come into the FEOP program. Savings and investments must be less than $10,000. That's higher than what Medicaid is. The premise is these are folks that are working. We want them to save money. We want them to be able to purchase that house and really to move up. All eligible children in a family must be covered before the adults can be covered. So we won't allow parents to leave their kids uncovered while they get coverage. And people receiving Medicaid or Medicare are not eligible for the program at the same time. The other thing we did that's a little bit different in Medicaid is we said you have 12 months of eligibility. So when someone comes into the FEOP program and is determined eligible, we say that's for 12 months, whereas Medicaid is for 6 months. And the reason we made that decision is these are working Oregonians. We really wanted them to put the issue of health care behind them so they didn't have to come into the office or send in their applications every 3 or 4 or 5 months, but we wanted to give them stability in terms of their health insurance benefits. Subsidy levels on page 15, you can see there, if someone earns under 125% of federal poverty level, we will pay 95% of the premium. Somebody between 125 and 150, 90%, and then it starts scaling down pretty rapidly, 70% and 50%. Why go up to 150 and it's kind of a pretty hefty summer subsidy? Primarily, it's if you look at some of the market basket analysis that's been done, people just don't have disposable income at those levels. And if you turn the page, you will see what we're talking about in some of these levels. Someone at 125% of the federal poverty level, if it's a single individual, is $970 a month. Now, you take yourself, let's say you're a 50-year-old female and you are earning minimum wage. You are going to be probably above that, by the way, if you're working full-time. Full-time is going to put you between 125 and 150% of poverty if for a single individual. But let's say that you're earning about $950 a month. You're out there working. You're trying to make it. You're 50 years old and you have diabetes. And you come to OMIP and you say, I want to enroll in the high-risk pool. And we say your premium is $360. Somebody that's earning $970, folks, can't afford health insurance in today's world. So the FEOP program really does allow those people who cannot obtain health insurance through Medicaid to help hopefully afford some of those premiums.
Mr. Chair.
Yeah, Representative Schaffer.
Yeah, you'll have to forgive me for asking and beating on this, but on all the benefit plans that you've described here today, do all of them offer women's contraceptives in their prescription drug benefits?
Mr. Chair, Representative Schaffler, I believe they do, but I can't speak to that because I don't know every group plan. Mm-hmm. And let me talk about how we look at these plans. I think in the individual market, most of that is covered or required now. In the group market, we basically don't offer a group plan. All we do is, let's say you apply for a subsidy, and we approve it based on your income. You will go to your employer. They will provide a certificate indicating what the coverage is, mm-hmm. Contract, what the coverage is, and what the premiums are. That coverage must meet a benchmark that's been established by the board, and it covers, I think, 19 benefit categories. Now, we don't go into each one of those and what each one of those categories is, but, well, baby care, immunizations, whatever it may be, that group plan has to meet that benchmark. Once you've been approved and you sign up for your group plan, when that is deducted from your check, you fax us, mail us, deliver us, however you want, a copy of your check stub that shows how much was deducted from your check. We, within 48 hours, get a reimbursement out to you for the subsidy portion of that premium. So there is some cash flow, but it's going to be generally less than a week before we are able to do that. In the individual market, they have really the choice of almost all the plans under $1,000 deductibles, and generally most people are either in a managed care plan like Kaiser, or they're in $500 deductible plans, and that have the full array of benefits other than dental, because we do not subsidize dental in the individual market. But you will make application to us for a subsidy. We will give you a certificate saying you're eligible for the subsidy. You'll go to Blue Cross or to Health Net or to ODS with that certificate, apply for coverage, and if you're accepted, they will use that certificate and bill us for the premium. So if the premium's $200, they bill us for the $200. We bill you for your share, whether that's 5%, 10%, 30%, or 50%. Get your money, combine it with our money, and send it to the carrier, so that it's very—it's all done electronically, and it's very efficient. Group market's a little bit more labor intensive, but again, we don't dictate, and that's one of the things that we ask is that the people that sign up for the program have the consumer choice to shop different plans. Other than the group market, they really have to take whatever their employer offers.
Representative Schaffer.
Yeah. Are your budgets going to be radically affected by the downturn in revenue? And how many? I mean, we're getting quite a bit of money back from the federal government for every dollar we put in.
Yep.
Can you kind of just give me a little idea of what's going on there? And how many people will be impacted negatively by any cut, please?
Representative Brown, Ms. Chair, Representative Schaffer. When we went to the federal government in 2002 to get the federal waiver, part of the agreement they had, we were spending about $8 million a year in state funds at that point in the program. It was state funded only. Part of the agreement with the federal government was what they call a maintenance of effort. And that basically said, we'll allow you to expand what you used to have just as a state program, but you have to agree to spend at least the same amount per year of state funds you spend in the program for a 5-year period of time is if you would have spent, if you would have just kept your program with state funds only. So we have what's called a maintenance of effort, and over a five-year period of time have to expend about $40 to $42 million of state funds, whether that be general funds, cigarette taxes, or whatever it may be, in order to meet the requirements of the federal government. If we don't do that, there's a possibility we could have to pay back the feds for any federal dollars that we brought in. Well, the problem we had was in 2001, 2003, and is we've had a budget shortfall. So every year that we've had this, we've artificially had to keep the number of enrollments down because of having to transfer some of those funds to other parts of the state and some of the other health care programs. So we are in a position during 2005 and 2007 budget that we'll have to have a 70% increase in the general fund portion of our budget in order to meet the maintenance of effort requirements. Now, that's good news, bad news. Good news, obviously, is the program stable, can grow and meet the needs. The bad news is it takes some of the options away from the governor and the legislature in terms of what the priorities may be for that $26 million of general fund for the FEOP program. So it's one of the few programs that is not cut. It's not even kept stable. It is increased during the 2005-2007 budget because of the maintenance effort requirements. If we would have expended those funds earlier and not cut the program and held the program down, we wouldn't be in that same situation. But the state faced a lot of needs over the last 4 years that have had to been met with some of the FEOP general fund money. Does that answer your question, Representative?
Thanks.
Okay, so we are at FEOP. We do both group and individual coverage. In July of this year, we started remarketing the program, opened up the reservation list, and we have about 8,000 people enrolled in the program now. It's about 8,400, with another 2,400 that have been approved for a subsidy and are in the process of getting health insurance. The governor made a decision to open up the market and or open up the individual market. We had been focusing almost all on group market prior to this in July, in June, July. So we really are doing a great deal of expansion over the next 6 to 7 months and hope to add 8,000 to 10,000 people to the FEOP roles. We can't do it all in 1 month because we don't have the administrative capacity to do that. We have to do it over a 6 or 7 or 8 month period of time.
Sorry, Mr. Chairman.
Representative.
Adding those 8,000 to 10,000, will that help us meet our federal waiver obligations?
Mr. Chair, Representative Schaffler, that'll be imperative to do that in order to meet our federal obligation. Because any funds we don't expend this biennium are just funds that we would have to expend additionally next biennium in order to meet that maintenance of effort requirement. On, if you'll turn to page, and I'm about done here, 23 of the agency overview, you can see some of that enrollment. At the top of that page, you'll see that of the 8,300, about 2,800 of those are children, 5,500 are adults, 19 and older. We primarily are in the individual market with... we got these, I think, turned around. No, we don't. We have 3,900, in the individual market and 4,400 in the, these figures are turned around. It should be 4,400 in the individual market and 3,900 in the group market. Group market, almost 50% of those that enroll are children. And if you go back to that statistic that I said about a lot of employers are no longer contributing towards dependent coverage, when we subsidize individuals in the group market, generally it is not the employee. The employer is taking care of the employee. Very often they'll provide up to 100% of the premium. It's the dependents that have a difficult time affording their share of the premium in the group market. So the dependents very often are kids. So you'll see that in the group market, about 50% of the enrollments are children and 50% are adults generally, the spouse of the employee that's getting their coverage through the employer. The average age is about 36, and for the individual market and for the group market, it's significantly lower, 23, because, again, 50% are in the are children. If you want to get an idea of what the costs are, you can turn to page 25, and you can see it shows you that an average premium per member is about $122, and we subsidize on average about $105 of that. The member contribution is $17, and employers contribute on average about $93 per member per month. So it's really leveraging state funds, employer contributions, and federal funds in order to provide coverage. And it's significantly less expensive in the group market because you bring in the employer contribution than it is in the individual market. If you turn the next page, you'll see the individual market, and this is non-OMIP. The prices are a little bit higher. $202 is the average premium. $184 is the average subsidy. The member contribution is about $18 to $19. This is for non-OMIP, and if you'll see there, about approximately a third of those individuals are children, about 900 of the enrollments in the non-OMIP, the non-high-risk pool, are children. The final page, as you can see, OMIP, where your average age is 50 years old, and again, about 70% female, you get a better picture of some of the costs of providing coverage to those with chronic health conditions. The average premium is $363, the subsidy per month is $330, and the member contribution is $33. It's important to note, every one of these folks has a copay and a deductible. And for example, if they're an OMIP or the individual market or the group market, they have a $500 to $1,000 deductible. They may have a 20% coinsurance. So it's not just the premium that they're making the contribution on. It is on the copays and deductibles. Somewhat different than the Oregon Health Plan Medicaid, where there may be a premium for some of the adults. Generally, the copays and the deductibles aren't as nearly as significant as they will be in the private sector side. I should also note that about 25% of those enrolled in FEOP earn under 100% of the federal poverty level. Those generally aren't individuals. Those are generally families with three or four kids, and because of family size, brings them significantly below the federal poverty level. So it's not just serving people between 100 and 185%. So, Mr. Chair, that's a real brief. Sometimes I can take 3 hours and sometimes 5 minutes, but that's a brief overview of the programs that we operate and what some of the rationale and context of the current environment they operate within.
Thank you, Rocky. Questions? Representative Holt.
Mr. Chair, thank you. I have to commend you for your work on this. This is an incredible amount of information that you've waded through, and you've done an excellent job of presenting it in a fairly understandable presentation. I've read many insurance policies that are much more complex, and you read them and you don't get an understanding of anything by the time you get to the end of it. But I want to ask a question. Did I hear you right as far as the FEOP or the subsidy programs that there's only about 17% of people who might be eligible that actually can get into the program because of financial constraints?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative Holbe, that is correct. It only was intended to serve, it really is a model and a test. We were the first in the nation to come out with the ability to really subsidize private health care purchase as opposed to expanding the public sector on Medicaid. And it has always had a dollar limit on it. And given Measure 30, go back to that, where it basically kind of took apart the Oregon Health Plan in terms of the standard population. Given the budget crisis that we've had in the 203 legislative session, where we had to pull back some of the dollars that initially were going into FEOP, we've basically had to keep a low profile. I mean, when you have a waiting list of 10,000, and not all those people, it's kind of a phantom waiting list. It's people that have gone on a waiting list to receive the information and application. It doesn't necessarily mean they were eligible. But it was somewhat discouraging to have people call up and say, I'd like to get into this program, and we'd say, well, it'll be at least a year's wait. So we kind of just stopped marketing the program and doing any training of agents or anything until July, when basically all the decisions about Measure 30 had been made about the standard population, and a decision by the governor that we needed to be very aggressive so that we met the maintenance of effort. So we're working as fast as we can to try to get word about the program out. Very discouraging. If anybody saw the Oregonian article yesterday, where some families talked about the uninsurance rate and what it meant to them, and I'm reading this article thinking, there's three families that just fit our profile perfect, and we've got to get in touch with them and let them know we're here. The problem is I'm backlogged 20 days on applications, and when you try to compress 2 years worth of enrollment into basically 6 months, you just don't have quite the administrative capacity to get through that process and get everybody on board as fast as you would like. So we're working overtime. We've got a lot of temps in. We're trying to do that to get it so that it's basically a 48-hour turnaround on an application so people can get coverage. And I mean, the calls are coming in, 2,500 last week, 2,300 the week before, so people have some interest in this.
Just one quick follow-up, and thank you, Mr. Chair. I probably got more questions than we have time for in this committee hearing, I'm sure. Given that, looking at it from an employee, just like an insurance plan, I'm going through here, and as you know, putting myself in the position of an employee that can't get into the FEOP plan, I'm looking at what my costs are, and I see that the cost of the employer contribution is $50, which I assume is per month, which is about 31 cents an hour. And I know family coverage is, you know, well over $5 an hour probably at this point in time. And given that the statistics you quote where employer plans have gone, you know, down from 49% to 29%, you know, I'm trying to figure out what I'm going to do as an employee, because I certainly can't make up another $4 or $5 an hour as an employee if I don't qualify for those plans. So, you know, just a lament, I guess, but that there's still a tremendous amount of people out there that are going to remain outside of the insurance program given the statistics you've offered.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hove, you're correct. And $50, by the way, is a minimum contribution. When we had the certified plans between 1989, basically in the year 2000, the average premium was generally about $130, I believe, even though we had $53 plans, people usually bought up better benefits. The average premium was in the $120 to $130 range for an employee, and generally the employer covered the full cost of that. The real problem is when you get into the dependent coverage. I mean, you look at paying $600, $700, $800 a month for a family, it's very difficult. That's why we designed a children's plan that has better benefits, and we can come in and subsidize that children's plan through a FEOP subsidy. So for the low-income folks.
Representative Esquivel.
Yes, you mentioned a couple times about diabetics being on this plan. Is this plan similar to what I was faced with being an independent contractor, where I was put into a pool where it was about $500 a month, I think it was, to get group policy or to get a policy on health care? And then the stipulations were basically they wouldn't cover anything to do with diabetes, which consisted of most everything that I have.
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Esquivel, if you're talking about the high-risk pool, that's not the case. I mean, the high-risk pool that's designed to provide the health care benefits for those with chronic illnesses, whether that's strips, whether that's insulin, you know, vision related to diabetes, that's what we cover. In the certified plans, the diabetes is going to be covered under the drug benefit, the doctor's benefit. I don't know what pool you were put in. Now, there are some pools, and I think you were in a meeting yesterday where we were talking about association plans that may design very limited benefit plans to keep some of the claims down and thus some of the premiums down. And you may, through the independent contractors or something like that, been in such a plan that had a little bit different kind of benefit package than what you would see in the normal market. But I assure you that a diabetic for any of these programs, whether it's the individual market subsidies that we do generally through almost all group plans, whether it's the high-risk pool, are going to get served the same as someone with cancer, someone with MS, someone with heart disease. We don't limit by disease here.
Representative Shield.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Rocky, I'd just like to say that when I started my organization, Better People, I found the alternative group plan to be very helpful as a temporary way when we started the organization to get us to the point where we could afford HMO coverage. I had a couple of questions. One, in these documents, is there a list of the IPG board somewhere of who the members are?
Mr. Chair, Representative Shields, I don't think so, but we have four board members now of the seven. They're holding three vacant because of a bill that's coming forward to actually abolish the board and just create them as an advisory capacity. But the four members are Ellen Lowe, who's an advocate. I think all of you will. If you don't know Ellen Lowe, you haven't been around here for a while, and she's just absolutely one of the most super people I know. We have Gary DeCamp, who has a computer consulting firm, a business owner in Eugene. Kevin McCartan, who is a consultant with an actuarial background, is on the board. Steve Doty, a health insurance agent. And who am I missing? And Diana McCoy, who used to be around the legislature many, many years ago. I think she worked in then Senator Bradbury's office, who now is a small business owner up in Portland. So it's a pretty good representation, I think, of folks, and their primary responsibility has been in the design and approval of the plans. They're not as much part to do with the FIOP program because that's more to do with the federal waivers and DHS.
Okay, follow up, Mr.
Chair. Follow up.
Thank you. Is there a document that the board approved or that you presented to the board that details the assumptions and the numbers and how it pencils out that you came to the conclusions of who's eligible, particularly for the alternative group plan, the 50 employees versus, say, another number or what the most reasonable deductible level would be?
Yes, Mr. Chair, Representative Shields, and I would like to introduce Cindy Bowman, who works on the FIOP program and is here to correct me whenever I make errors. I believe all that information is on the website.
I believe so.
We have all the decision documents are on our website, IPGB, whatever it is here. It's a new, all the new state websites, but I'll get you the website. Don't have it off the top of my head, but I can put a packet together and get that over to you before next week.
Yeah,
also.
I appreciate it. And then one final yes or no question.
One more question.
Please, thank you, Mr. Chair. So my understanding is there is no time limit that when somebody goes into the alternative group plan, they can stay there forever.
And Mr. Chair, Representative Shields, there is no time limit. However, there is a sunset on the certified plan legislation that sunsets in 2008 unless the legislature takes action. But no, they could stay there for as long as they wanted to stay there. I should point out that you're probably targeting businesses that generally are going to have under 10 employees. Our experience with IPGB certified plans in the past is if you had a larger employer, generally 5 and above, that came in, very frankly, it would be for a short time and they would transition out to the regular market. That really was serving more mom and pop shops more than anybody else, I think.
Any other questions, Rocky? Thank you very much, Rocky, for coming. Very good presentation. Thank you. Pardon? Yeah. Okay, I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2062, and we can tell how hot these issues are. We have no one signed up to testify, and so we'll start with Rocky.
Chair, members of the committee. For the record, again, I am Rocky King. I'm the administrator for the Insurance Pool Governing Board, and with me is Cindy Bowman, who works for the IPGB programs, both the certified plan and FEOP. I'm not going to read the testimony. It will take too long, but what I'm going to go through very briefly on each of the bills that you have before you, I really have kind of a summary and bisection of what's involved, and I'm briefly going to address those. I will say at the beginning that since we were put on the schedule and the number of discussions we've had with some of the stakeholders, both independent contractor representatives as well as some of the carriers, there are two or three issues that we want to get together with them to make sure that we clarify through an amendment that we would like to bring back to you at a future work session, and I'll address what those are when we go through. But basically, House Bill 2062, and I'm hoping that I tipped me. Got it. In summary, defines a small employer eligible to purchase the agency's new certified plans, both the alternative and the children's group plan, and provides some flexibility to employers by allowing for them to cover one class of employees versus all classes of employees, and usually we say management versus non-management. And that is one issue, one of the issues we want to work with stakeholders on, because it was not our intent to just have a business owner buy for themselves but not the rest of the employees by saying they're management and nobody else is. So we want to look at some language with the carriers to ensure that that doesn't create an adverse selection issue for them. Further, the bill provides authority for the board to set contribution levels for employers. Previously, with certified plans, we were allowed by statute to have them contribute a minimum of $40. We've added to this statute, give the board the same authority to set that contribution level. In House Bill 2537, passed in 2003, it happened towards the end of the session, and some of the things just didn't get put in from our previous statutory authority going back to 1987. Finally, we want authority to impose a temporary assessment on the carriers. We call it an administrative fee on a per enrolled or per plan or based on premiums that will help us in some of the marketing and outreach and training that we're doing around the certified plans. Again, there were no funds allocated by the legislature for us to do this and for us to pay for the brochures and go to the 23 cities. We are incurring costs that we've been able to pay for so far with savings and some of our other programs, our marketing information and outreach, but we don't think that that can continue. I've listed the 14 sections on House Bill 2062. One of the problems with all of these bills, if you've tried to read them, is because of the sunset provision in 2008, there are a lot of duplicate sections. You think they're duplicate, but there may be some minor changes. And what that means is that when it sunsets in 2008, the Legislative Council is using this opportunity to set the statutes back to where they were so you don't have to come back to have the bill done again. The sunset just takes place. For example, Section 2 or Section 1 does nothing but restore what Section 2 does effective 2005. Section 3 does nothing but restore references that are changed in 2005 in Section 4. And it gets very confusing to read. But again, Section 2 defines eligible employee. It excludes independent contractors and those who have been employed for fewer than 90 days, and it defines a small employer. We are going to work with the independent contractors to basically clarify that language around the definition of eligible employee and small employer so that there's no confusion. Eligible employee is not an independent contractor, and this bill takes that out, and it would be much more clear to leave it in, and we're going to take care of that through an amendment. Section 5 excludes outdated reference to medical savings accounts, and it relates to FEOP, not the certified plans. Section 6 changes the word applicant to bidder when putting out requests for proposals to third-party administrators. Section 7 are minor technical references. Section 8 deletes reference to medical savings accounts. Section 9 or 10 relate to references, and one is just restoring in 2008. Section 11 are the substantive pieces, I believe. Authority for the board to set the contribution levels of employers. Again, they've set $50 initially. Reestablishes authority for an employer to offer one or more employee classes. We're going to work with the carriers with some clarifying language on that to make sure that we don't get into game playing and adverse selection by some employers. And we also don't want to penalize, in the third part of Section 11, employers that have maybe purchased individual coverage through their business, because you have to be uninsured as of July of 2003. But if you're a small business with five employees and you're the owner, you may have well had your business purchase your health insurance for you. We don't want to disqualify the entire business and all the employees just because you did something to benefit yourself. So that allows us to do that. Section 12, during the RFP process with the carriers, it was agreed that we would have an administrative fee built into the rates. However, when we at the last minute really were looking at references and the contracts, it was determined that we did not have statutory authority to collect or assess or collect those fees. So we are asking for that authority and exemption from the fee bill, so whether it goes up a nickel or down a nickel, we don't have to go through an extensive legislative and administrative review process on any fee change. There is a limit of 1% of premiums. I don't envision that we would get to 1% of premiums. What we're talking about really is, I think it was a dollar per member per month. Number 13 excludes the assessment from the assessment and fee requirements that under current Oregon statutes. And Section 14 really just takes out a reference to the IPBG assessments based on the sunset of the certified plans. That's a quick summary, Ms. Chair. I'm happy to answer questions. Again, it is our intent to work with stakeholders, some carriers, and representatives of independent contractors to come back with some amendments that will give a little bit better clarity to a couple of the provisions here, hopefully next week.
Representative Schaffler.
Thank you. Are there prescription drug benefits in these plans? Will they all be covering women's contraceptives as well?
I believe, Ms. Chair, Representative Schaffler, these are the certified plans, the alternative plan, and the children's group plan, and I believe they do.
And may I follow?
Follow.
I'm far from an insurance expert. I'm good with a shovel, though. Do all the plans in Oregon cover women's contraceptives?
Ms. Chair, Representative Schaffler, I can get back to you. I can contact the insurance division and get a better picture of what the general market is.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Any other questions? Representative Shields.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It seems to me, in my experience as a social worker, as well as somebody who started an organization, that the bulk of people who would take advantage of drug and alcohol treatment services probably would be dissuaded from seeking it if there was a $1,000 deductible. So that being the case, it would seem to me not many addicts would actually take advantage of it. Why not include it in the services covered, since my gut tells me that few people would take advantage of it anyway?
Yeah, Ms. Chair, Representative Shields, complicated answer here, but let me try the best I can. If we include mental health and chemical dependency benefits, we may pick up an additional premium of 4 to 5%. Who knows what it could be. The reality is that we wanted to have a 30% reduction, and we couldn't have every benefit in there to get that. If you are a small employer and you have people that have mental health and chemical dependency kinds of needs, then what I would encourage is to look at the regular market, because they have the option of getting those benefits through the regular market. Now, very frankly, you're not going to see a lot of a lot of, I think, unhealthy, and the actuaries say this to us, a lot of unhealthy people sign up for these plans because the benefit structure is that it is more catastrophic or just kind of the normal care oriented rather than somebody that has specific needs around mental health, for example, chemical dependency or drug needs. The drug co-pays are very, very high. If you just had a transplant and you have an ongoing $18,000 a year drug bill that, you know, you may have to pay a 50% copay for, this is not the plan that you want to get into.
One quick follow-up, Mr. Chair. But if I recall correctly, if a business is going to do this, let's say you have five employees, all five employees have to be part of the plan, right? You don't have a choice to...
Mr. Chair, you have 100% of participation for employees. That is correct. So the employee may not have a choice, but the employee, Representative Shields, is uninsured. I mean, you're talking about a whole bunch of folks that have nothing today. And what, you know, paraphrase one of the other legislators that I met with yesterday, at least this gives some people an opportunity to get something. But is this a good plan that I want as the standard plan throughout this state? No way.
Thanks.
No way.
Representative Shoffler.
It's better than a poke in the eye, I guess. But, and then, just so I know from my own knowledge here, when this becomes law and people start enrolling in it and the numbers start coming in, that'll also help us towards meeting our federal waiver obligation as well.
Mr. Chair, Representative Shoffler, only to the extent that there are individuals that children that enroll in the children's group plan,
right,
that we're able to use the FEOP subsidy. I should tell you that the general alternative plan does not meet our benefit requirements to subsidize it under FEOP. We have some pretty good standards about what we'll use the subsidy to purchase, and we're kind of, we have to manage all these programs. So I got one side of me that says, you know, get something out there so we can get some people insured, at least something. I mean, we're at 600,000 people uninsured. The other side says, but you know, you're putting something out there, you're not going to subsidize. The fact of the matter is, yeah, we just need to get some choices and some options out there because it's a tough time now to get coverage to small businesses.
I second that. Any other questions? Committee, this bill has a referral to Ways and Means, too, so when we get through working, it'll go on down to there, to that committee. I want to close the public hearing on House Bill 2062 and open the public hearing on parallel public hearing on House Bill 2063 and 2064. And Janet, I ignored you last time.
That's okay, Mr. Chair. Thank you. House Bill 2063 is pretty much a housekeeping bill, clarifying terminology, and this time it's not in the certified plans, but in the Family Health Insurance Assistance Program, or the acronym is FEOP, deleting obsolete references, and that was also done in the other bill, to an account that no longer exists, and replacing the term applicant with bidder when referring to a company applying to be a third-party contractor. That's, again, a clarification. And I think the other changes are just a technical. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Janet. Rocky, we'll turn back to you again.
On House Bill 2063, I think Committee Administrator set up well. It basically is a housekeeping bill that relates to the FEOP program and excludes the outdated references to medical savings accounts and provides authority to the board to better define what a resident means and what the residency requirements are. And that was at the suggestion of Legislative Council to change the piece relating to resident, giving the board better authority to add some additional requirements that in the future it may want to add. That's House Bill 2063. Would you like me to go through 2064 at the same time?
Why don't you go right ahead?
2064, Mr. Chair, the real substantive issues are in Section 5, and it relates to dependent elderly relative or dependent adult disabled children and FEOP. When you determine eligibility for FEOP, we look at family size and income. children are defined in our statutes as 23 years of age or younger, and there are some other requirements for those. They have to be dependent, etc. But there are occasions now that we run into where somebody has an elderly parent that lives with them, or they have a disabled child that may be 30 or 35 years old. When we go to determine the family size, we currently can't include them in the family size in determining eligibility, whereas they may be providing full support for the elderly parent or for the disabled child. So what you end up doing is having to determine eligibility on the basis of them separately, and very often the income will be too high for the person that's applying, the basic caregiver, and they're denied coverage because we haven't included all the family members. All this does is allow us really to include those folks that people have taken care of, that are relatives, either children or their parents, in determining how much, how big their family should be, and then applying it against what income they should have. It'll mean only probably to a small handful of people in the state, but very often it's the handful of people that you want to serve the best because they're out there trying to keep care of their kids and their parents. The second part of that is it clarifies the definition of income, and just to make sure that unearned income on the part of children is not included when we look at family income. Again, it gives the board authority to define resident as it does in Bill 2063. And finally, under Section 7, all the other changes are technical except here it inserts the word eligible before children. As you recall, I've always said in most of these programs, we require that they cover the children if they want to cover the adults. And we say in there, all children must be covered in order for the adults to get coverage. Well, the problem is you may have a child that's not eligible for the program, so you may have four kids, one that's not eligible. And we go in there and say, you have to enroll all of them, but by the way, one of them you can't enroll, which means nobody gets enrolled. So all we're doing is inserting and saying, any eligible kid, child that you have responsibility for in FEOP, you need to enroll. If they're not eligible, you don't have to enroll them, but when they become eligible for our program, you have to enroll them. Again, we want to make sure the kids get coverage before the adults do whenever possible. So it's very, I think, very minor changes, but significant to a small number of families.
Any questions on either 2063 or 2064? None. Yes. Let's see.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Do you anticipate any amendments to 2063 or 2064?
Mr. Chair, at this time, I do not.
Okay. Thank you. Okay. The chair's intent is that these bills will be brought back next week sometime to work and sent on by the time we get to when we get amendments for 2062. I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2063 and House Bill 2064, and open a work session on to introduce some committee bills. Committee before you have LC 237, 238, 239, and 240. And again, adopting these bills as committee bills in no way commits you either to in support of or in opposition to the bills. It's merely to get them into the process. And the chair would entertain a motion.
So moved.
Representative Schaffer moves that LC 237, 238, 239, and 240 be introduced as committee bills. Any discussion? Seeing none, is there any opposition? If not, adopted as committee bills. Janet, do we have anything else?
No, Mr. Chair. And, I did want to ask Mr. Chair if we just have, I think, have a pot of regular coffee, if that's what most people want. But getting a pot of decaf or a pot of tea would add to the expense, and I don't know that anybody needs it.
We need the caffeine.
With this cold, what about a little old
the real thing down here. He needs the caffeine.
The real thing down here.
Well, what I want, they ain't going to bring us. So.
Yeah, I don't even think they serve in the building, do they?
Okay, is there anything else? If there's no objection, we are adjourned.
I went ahead and filled out a...